Welcome to the weekend edition of the Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. On today's program, we got a lot to cover, as always, and looking forward to introducing you to today's guests. But in addition to that, I do want to mention that the Price of Business, which is one of the longest running business shows in the country, continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com. We are adding new content all the time. There you can see all of our regular guests. We have reoccurring guests from Fox Business, from Yahoo Finance, gentlemen like Cody Willard, who was a longtime CNBC and Fox Business anchor. He's on this program every single week. And so we're excited by the talent that we bring you. Also, I do want to mention I've got a book called Making New Rich Books Work for You, and exclusively for our listeners of this program. It's available at a ridiculously low price. You want to get more information about that, go to priceofbusiness.com. If you read anything by people like Tim Ferriss or Robert Kiyosaki, who's been on my show many, many times, and you know, really were excited but had little to show for it when you try to pursue those things, my book explains why. There's something going on, and the problem really isn't with these authors. It's usually with the reader. And you can get more information about that at priceofbusiness.com. With that, here's our first guest right here on The Price of Business. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. We want to remind you the show continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com, where we're always adding new content, audio, video, articles, and more. And make sure while you're there, sign up for our free newsletter called Read Instead. And one of the people you'll find over there is my guest this segment. She's our global commentator, and we love having her on the program, Getty Midler. And she not only brings a very unique perspective from the way, you know, really her worldview, but also from where she is geographically. I love that we bring that and bring her to the program. Getty, welcome back to the program. A little bit about what you do, where you are, and the best website for people to get more information. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you again. I'm based here in Denmark, in Europe, Northern Europe. And what I'm doing is that I'm a keynote speaker, and I'm a facilitator, and I'm a mentor for the corporate world or for anyone else who is interested in foresight and also how we transform our businesses from being much more aware of our energy consciousness and how we can unfold our intuition. So it's really about business, people, and how we create a better world.
Very good.
The website is called, my website is called energeticleadership.eu.
Yes, and people should check that out. Great topic today, ties into exactly what you're all about, and also ties into what's going on the world stage, how pursuing peace from within can create world peace. That's what we're going to focus on today. And, you know, one of the things, as you well know from our conversations, Getty, is that I'm a big fan of Stoicism. Frankly, I think it's the only thing that's prevented me from jumping off the ledge when I look what's going on in a larger culture. You know, you look at someone like Marcus Aurelius, who was really the only true philosopher king that I could think of in history, and truly someone who, as king, emperor, if you will, of the Roman Empire, was dealing with a huge plague that was making the Roman people drop like flies, dealing with attacks from the Persians, attacks really throughout the entire peripheral of the empire, and yet somehow pursued inner peace. And in the end, there seemed value in that. But I also am optimistic like you are. You know, if we start projecting peace, I think we can begin to influence that in the world we're in. And I think that's a big part of what you focus on.
Yes, I actually, you know, find the world stage quite interesting at the moment, because when you take what is happening outside and you sort of also look at what you are able to do with yourself, but the world stage at the moment where We have seen world leaders negotiating the last couple of days, and they have, in a way, progressed a lot over the last months. We can always talk about whether they will need or reach some kind of an agreement, but in some way, some people have at least looked inside themselves and tried to move something around or concede or whatever. And that is really my point. We have so much inner work that we can do, and that will transform into whether you are a world leader or a leader in your own life or a business leader.
Yeah, I think so. And it's so strange. I mean, how many world leaders did it take in order to contain Trump not to do anything dangerous? You know, I was very impressed and very grateful for the world leaders that came and visited and really created good guardrails, brought common sense, made it very difficult for Trump to go off the rails, which I think a lot of people believe he's good at doing that. And, you know, it's a very interesting time for the world. And really, I do get concerned about it because the world has depended on U.S. leadership. And I certainly would like to see the U.S. maintain leadership. But at the same time, it's been really refreshing to see particularly the European powers say, oh, maybe we're going to have to lead more. And they have been doing just that.
Yeah, I think the Europeans are stepping up, or at least also that's what we hear in the media in Europe. But they are also saying that a lot of it has everything to do with that Trump, he wants to win this Nobel Prize, and he wants to go to heaven, they say, here in Denmark in the news. So, yes, there can be a lot of motives for why you're doing it. But coming back to what is inner peace and how are you able to create it from, you say, a holistic and a healthy place, is when you have your integrity with you. So that is also always the issue, I think, when you look at what is happening also on the world stage. Because are they actually having their integrity with them? You know, it could be all parties, even the Europeans. We have been too lazy for too long, and now we're waking up. So, maybe a more balanced world in between all the big areas could be healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, and we certainly hear what you just said in the U.S. about Europe. Too lazy, too dependent, those type of things. But let's face it, when at the end of World War II, the U.S. so incredibly protected by an ocean and didn't have nearly the issues that Europe had with the German war machine. And we had a very robust economy relatively speaking. The United States really asserted itself in both a positive way, but in a way that also made it very difficult for the Europeans not to become dependent. You know, at what point does a European say, oh, okay, we've grown up enough, we don't want or need your help anymore, let's just be partners. They're not going to do that any more than a 13-year-old or 14-year-old isn't going to say, hey, I'm ready to, be an adult now, as mom and dad gives that teen or even a 20-something-year-old more than he needs and prohibits their growing up. And so, sure, I think there's no doubt about it. It was past due. On the other hand, the European leaders have always been pretty bright. And they're not going to say no to a good thing, which is what the U.S. Did in perpetuity. I blame the U.S. for European dependence on us more than I even do the Europeans.
Yeah, well, at least we are getting together in Europe, and we also have very strong beliefs in our democracies and our way of trusting people, and so there's a lot of good values to build upon in Europe. But yes, we have been behaved a little bit like teenagers for the last couple of decades, and now we are waking up. But also in Europe, it's it's the group of the willing that's doing it, you know, those who want to work together. So it's very much about collaboration.
Yeah, no question about it. And I'm curious, because now they're talking a lot about the potential of troops, European troops, and the United States has said it's not happening. Trump has said we're not sending American troops. Trump has said we're not even giving necessarily a large amount of the equipment that's needed, but you guys can buy it. Europe can buy it, which is something, because there was a while where he had pulled back from even that, where he was just saying, yeah, we're not sending anything, buy it or not. That lasted this days, fortunately. What are Europeans saying about the prospects of European troops going to the Ukraine to help create security once a treaty is done?
Well, they say that the Europeans will be there to protect peace when an agreement has been made. So that is a different way of, we're not going to be in the forefront, apparently. But you never know. We are still, we have Finland and we have Poland, and they're very close to Russia, and they have huge arms, forces and everything. So they are, very frightened about where the next step will be from Russia's side, if it's going to be into the Baltics, or which is not far from Denmark, and or Finland or whatever. But at the moment, it is only as a peace, soldiers for peace when a peace agreement has been made.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It would be insane otherwise, right? Otherwise, they're fighting. They're going to war, which, no one in Europe is looking for that, except for, if you want to call it Russia, Europe. It's only Russia that's interested in war. I'm expecting Poland to play a huge role in that. Now it has the second largest and the second most sophisticated conventional army in the world, second only to the United States. That blows my mind. So that to me is interesting. I expect them to take a leadership role. You talk to those countries that have lived under Russian or Soviet tyranny, they come to fight. they know what they're dealing with. They remember in a way that, frankly, Americans certainly don't understand, and a lot of the Western Europeans have never actually dealt with that. And so, at least it's been a very long time. And so, it's an interesting time. You were talking. I was reading some notes in preparation of this, including insights you had. Talk a little bit about the geopolitics of all this as we begin to wrap this up. The old versus the new. So that's a lot of what's going on, particularly Eastern Europe's new leadership role, as well as part of Eastern Europe, like Hungary, going, well, we kind of like the old ways. It's an interesting dichotomy, don't you think?
Oh, yes. It's funny about humans that we do like what we're used to, whether it's not something that we don't thrive on. But I think in Europe, we have the EU and the European Union, but still we are seeing a lot of collaboration across countries who are willing to do it in a hopefully in a peaceful way, but a negotiable way and a balanced way. So they are talking also to the UK. They are talking to Canada. They are talking to Australia, so it's like it's a new beginning of a new way of being. We call it Europeans, but for me, it's sort of increasing. It's more about how you are in the world leadership in the future, more than where you are based. And so that is very interesting, because what is it really that Trump or the United States which side are you choosing? That is what there's a lot of talk about. Or are we seeing just Trump walking around, as they say in Denmark, without clothes on? Mm-hmm. You know, can we rely on what he's doing, or can we not?
Yeah, that's a question I think anyone dealing with Trump, be it domestically or globally, should ask. I think now he's got a lot of problems with our Jeffrey Epstein issue, which is probably well known in Europe, where he is showing up in logs and journals and such and papers related to the convicted pedophile, right? And I'm afraid a lot of his actions are driven by that. In other words, trying to create distraction rather than by what's in the global interest. You know, and he's always been kind of reactionary. Who knows what Trump's going to do, right? Nobody knows. I'm not sure if Trump knows.
No.
But this whole Jeffrey Epstein thing, which has got him shaken up, no doubt about it. And I'm not accusing him of being a pedophile, although some people have, particularly among the Democrats. I think bigger issue is that he knows more than he wants people to know he knows, simply because of how much he shows up in that paperwork. Regardless, I don't like seeing leadership who have such personal issues that it forces them to put those issues above the interests of those that they have to work with or work for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what I'm seeing, unfortunately, with the case with Trump. Very, very hard to watch that. And he's not the only one who's done that. Bill Clinton, who was being impeached over his affair, was all of a sudden wildly interested in what was going on in Africa, you know, and sending forces there, you know, because that it all becomes about distraction at some point. We're in trouble. We're going to distract. And the United States isn't the only one who does that type of thing. And so, yeah, I think you have every right to be concerned about that in Europe. We're running out of time. Final thoughts as we wrap this up from you, Getty, and give your website one more time.
Yeah, my website is energeticleadership.eu, because one thing that's not scarce is energy. And if we tap into our, you know, own self, we can find that true answer and not try and be guided by our egos or wanting to have the Nobel Prize. You know, it will be given if you don't ask for it, so to speak.
I like it. Thank you so much. I'm Kevin Price, guest Getty Medeiros, and love her global leadership that she brings to our program. Make sure you check out her website, plus you'll see her everywhere on the Price of Business Digital Network. Stay tuned for more after this. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. Love my chats with Lee Kaplan. Lee, always glad to have you on the program. Before we get started, just take 1 minute to talk about your firm and the best website to learn about that firm. And welcome.
Thank you. Our firm is Murphy Ball Stratton. We are a trial firm, and we do trials, arbitrations, appeals, mediations. All of our lawyers work for federal judges. And quite frankly, I'm the senior person at that firm, but I am far from the smartest there. The young lawyers have tons of moxie, and they're creative. Our website is mbssmartlaw.com. So that's Murphy Ball Stratton, but it's mbssmartlaw.com. And you can see the individual lawyers' biographies and see whether you want to talk to any of them. Because when people have problems, somebody needs to work on them and be creative and try to be efficient. And that's what we have been able to do. We've had good fortune, and we hope to keep that up.
Yeah, there we go. We're going to get starting on our topic today. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, the post incredibly catastrophic flooding in Texas that captured the nation's attention, and certainly Texas. A lot going on. Abbott, in the past week, activated a state emergency response ahead of potential storms. We'll have to see what that looks like. There's so much more around rhetoric rather than around actual action, that at least as far as I've seen. But it's a huge conversation. Over 100 people have died, many still missing. It's an incredible catastrophe.
It is, and the response of state government and local government is quite frankly scary because it's so inadequate. There's a lot more blame shifting than there is problem solving. And I personally feel that this is a state issue because we have rivers that run through counties, not just a county, but through counties, and the state should take responsibility for all of those things. We have natural disasters that usually states are equipped to handle if they have the will. But in Texas, we have so much alleged tax cutting that local municipalities are forced to try to deal with issues that should be statewide concern. And I would place that right at the feet of the governor.
I largely agree with you. It's fun watching particularly the lieutenant governor in the blame shifting game. It's quite astonishing. But I largely agree with you, but I think foundational for every state, for every area, is information. And the cuts, the dramatic cuts that DOGE did without congressional approval on the National Weather Service has led to complaints all over the country in terms of the quality of information they're now receiving. And that happened in this case as well. And they talked about in the past we would have got this and said we got this, and this was completely off. And so I agree with you, and frankly, it doesn't cost that much to go back to restoring the type of National Weather Service we had before the DOGE cuts. But that information is great as long as the states use it. And I think there's a case that can be made that I think you are making that Texas has done a poor job even when they had the information.
Well, why everybody appeals to the lowest common denominator is hard to understand. People often vote because they're mad. They don't vote because they're satisfied with something and they want to continue it. They vote because they're mad. And currently the madness in Texas is I'm overtaxed. And the truth is we're not really overtaxed. We have different tax systems, a federal system that has an income tax, a state system that requires sometimes income taxes, but I think would be better focused on property taxes and other user fees. But the truth is, we are not overtaxed for the services that we want, and people should stop being so selfish.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. That's a really hard sell, though. And because people, let's face it, Lee, nobody wants to be taxed at all, or everybody wants to be taxed.
Of course, I don't stand up and say, gosh, I wish my property taxes were higher, but yeah. I have the luxury of a beautiful home and I should be paying for it. And my income taxes are not higher because I have a beautiful home, but my state and county property taxes are. And that's fair. I've made a personal choice, and we all should do that.
Yeah. Well, the Republican narrative really since the 1980s has been whatever you're paying in taxes, you're paying too much. That's been the Republican narrative, in my opinion. And I've been one who has advocated that type of view, not with such simplicity, but when you get down to it. And, the reality is that we've got so many things that need to be corrected that will only be corrected with more money. I believe, what happened in Flint, Michigan, and now in some other cities, particularly in the Northeast, with their pipes leading to lead issues, all the pipes created in that generation all over the country, particularly in older cities, they're going to have similar problems. We've got, you know, bridges that are collapsing. We have a lot of really serious systemic problems from an infrastructure and health perspective that we simply want it to go away. We certainly don't want to spend money to mitigate. There's a lot of money that needs to be spent to get us into something resembling modernity.
We did not get to be the richest country in the world by being incredibly selfish.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my bottom line, and I'm sticking to it.
Yep, makes a lot of sense. So what do you think? Obviously, you know, when you got an incredibly, you know, Republican-dominated, and by the way, if Democrats were in charge, it would be the exact same way. You're not going to see a whole lot of consequences for the people politically in charge when that massive flood killed so many people. You're not going to see it, in my opinion, at least not on a state level. You know, and so I don't know how much change is going to happen without accountability, because that is part of the problem. But what's your sense tell you? Are we going to hear a lot of rhetoric, a lot of cosmetic change, or do you think there's a possibility we could see something meaningful happen?
I think that we will have more local taxes, but we will, and maybe we'll have some state fund created to do things, but it will then be rated in the future. So if we're really lucky, the state will have a disaster fund that is useful. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they'll talk and they'll study it again, and we'll get nowhere. And that is my unfortunate assessment of what's going to happen. Our governor and lieutenant governor have no real interest in prepping for catastrophes. What their real interest is getting reelected, period.
Yeah, no question about it. It's a short-sightedness effect on steroids. You know, their whole role operates, in the case of those people you mentioned, with 4 years. And beyond that, that's someone else's problem. So that's unfortunate, but that's a short-sightedness effect that you have with democracy. And that's not an anti-democratic statement. It's just something you have to factor in, and the calculus of governing and why governing is often so not so good. Lee Kaplan, appreciate our time as always. Give your website one more time, please.
It's mbssmartlaw.com, two S's in the middle. And you can look up all the lawyers at that website and see what you think.
There you go. Thanks so much, Lee Kaplan. Enjoy our chat as always. I'm Kevin Price. Stay tuned for more after this. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. He is back, Michael Marino. He's joining me, an attorney who's a negotiator, who is never lost the art of negotiation. You know, we talk about it. That seems to be an increasingly lost art. We now live in a world of unless someone's injured in negotiation processes, using air quotes for negotiation process, unless there's an injury, unless there's humiliation, unless there's brutality, they're not successful. And that is clearly not the case. Michael Marino, in his series that he's been doing, he's an attorney who has been negotiating his whole professional life. He proves that in every single episode. And a great analogy that he's been using was the Kenny Rogers song, Hold 'em and Fold 'em. Know when to walk away, know when to run. And very, very great parallels there between the art of negotiation and that song. We can learn a lot from it. Michael, real quickly, just a little about your firm and the best website to learn more about your firm.
Well, thank you again, Kevin. As you know, always a pleasure, and really look forward to these opportunities, as you say, to kind of try to reinforce some of the things that we have a tendency in this really quick world of limited attention span, that there are some good historical lessons that I think are proven over and over again. So as you mentioned, yes, I am a lawyer and based in New York City, part of a large global law firm, Seyfarth, and Seyfarth.com is our website, and we do have offices around the world, and And we have about 1,000 lawyers, 600 of whom are use these skill sets. All the lawyers do, of course, in whatever area, but lots of labor and employment representing management, but also a lot of high-profile CEOs and sports celebrity-type things where negotiations and getting to the definition of what constitutes success and what constitutes winning. So I think that's the thread that runs through all of our conversations.
Yep, it does. And you do such a good job. And really, what, you know, I think the thing that has captured the interest of listeners when we get feedback is the use of nuance. And there's one tool that we use the most in our conversation, it's nuance. And it's almost like that is a bad word these days.
Yes. And I think actually, of course, the opposite should be true. And I love the reference back to those iconic lyrics of our old friend Kenny Rogers, because it really captures what is important. You do need to know, as we talked about in the last session, you know, you got to know when to hold them. You got to screw yourself in the seat. You got to sit there. You got to listen. But there does come a time when, hey, it's time to lay down the cards. We got to fold them. And I think that the confusion and the misperception by a lot of the hyperbole that we face is that folding does not necessarily mean defeat, nor that you didn't accomplish your objective. Because, again, the objective is defined by you or by your client. And again, whether you're on the global stage or whether you're at the farmer's market, the principles are really the same. What mm-hmm. is the objective you need to accomplish?
Yeah, and that's a great way to get started in our conversation today. So set the stage for us. Today, we're going to talk about folding. And really, it's an interesting terminology because it is so much more than just folding them in this scenario. I love it.
Absolutely. Well, as you know, you've stimulated me to kind of reflect before we have these conversations, which are just so delightful for me also, and really look forward to it. And one of the things that kind of popped into my head was what I think is historically, perhaps all biases aside from a layman perspective, but one of the probably greatest negotiations and world diplomacy in our recent American history. And I'm referring to what we call 13 days in October, which was the navigating of the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, by a young, very inspiring, certainly to the baby boomer generation, President Kennedy. And I think that the lessons there, the public lessons, the private things, all of the things that we have talked about really came to fruition during that time period.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of hope, a lot of optimism, you know, and, you know, part of the power of his negotiating, you know, approach. And it really was negotiating, even though I don't think there's a lot of phone time. You know what I mean? But there's a lot of negotiating going on. You know, the great strength that Kennedy had, and I'm not a romantic on Kennedy. All presidents are complicated. And he, in some ways, is particularly complicated when you look at the totality of his presidency. But one thing he brought to the table that I think showed up mightily is the fact that he had fought in World War. That he won medals for heroism in World War. He saw carnage that you only see in a war. And, man, that really played a huge, you know, in his inauguration speech, he talked about tempered by war. That generation, he represented a new generation of Americans who were tempered by war. That showed up in his negotiations.
100%. And you know, two touchstones that you mentioned, certainly as with so many figures in the public limelight historically, he was a complicated individual, but inspirational for sure. And your point about his service, that was not a Hollywood presentation. He was in fact a naval hero. And he also, I think, set the stage for something that all of us cry out for, and that is profiles and courage. Like, how do you ultimately do the right thing? So with that background, very quickly, just to refresh some of the historical facts of what had happened, you know, Kennedy had been involved in a misstep, kind of a disaster, when Fidel Castro, of course, had taken over in communist Cuba, just 90 miles from our border. And Kennedy did authorize the Bay of Pigs invasion, which, again, still being debated probably today, decades later, but it was a disaster. And so Castro was able to negotiate secretly with Khrushchev to place nuclear weapons. And think about that. We all now know the impact of what can happen. Those weapons are only 90 miles from our shore. So our first takeaway, aside from even then, the amazing technology of the United States in the sense that, you know, we didn't have satellites then, but we sure had these U-2 surveillance planes. They pick up those missiles, and Kennedy knows he has to act. So here you're talking about a serious negotiation that has to be handled delicately. The first thing he did, knowing he had to act quickly, was he came up with words, the right words, and words matter. And this, again, words matter. When you're trying to get those Roma tomatoes from our friend Sal in the farmer's market, you know, you're not going to insult him. And so Kennedy said, hey, I'm sending these Navy warships, but it's not a blockade, which is a term of war. It's a quarantine. We're going to set up a quarantine. And it was, I think, the first message back to Khrushchev, who, despite all of his hyperbole, understood that, hey, listen, Kennedy doesn't want to ignite this torch any more than we do. So those are lessons, again, that we really have to think about. That next 13 days, very, very challenging. Many negotiations, complicated negotiations, also take 13 days or 13 months. But the key is define, always know your core principles. We had to prepare. You know, they had studied Khrushchev. They knew his personality. They knew how to look for signs. And you had to do all of that preparation, and you had to find the window that could navigate a win that in this case may have appeared like Khrushchev was folding, but we learned, especially later and through history,
much later,
that he may have folded, but he also got his own wins.
That's right. Yeah, missile removal from Turkey, if I recall correctly, were pointing right at Russia. And but you know, it's interesting. They alluded to it a little bit here and there. For many years, though, it was discussed as if it were two separate stories. You know, the Turkey missile removal and the Cuban Missile Crisis missile removal, as if they were two different stories. It was really like the 70s before you began to really clearly see it was a quid pro quo, which, you know, made perfect sense.
Absolutely. And then, of course, the other thing is, I think that we were getting ready to saddle up and take another run at Castro, and Khrushchev got that as his quid pro quo, because, of course, part of Castro's pitch would have been, hey, I need those nuclear weapons so that they don't invade me. So Khrushchev agrees to take them down, and in return gets a pledge from the administration that they are not going to try to reinvade Castro again. Now, they tried a couple other schemes that didn't work either, but there was no public humiliation of Castro. So I think it's a basket of lessons about the art of negotiation. Everything from knowing your opponent, defining what hold 'em means, what fold 'em means, and recognizing that, listen, set that objective. We've talked about that from day one. All of the posturing, all the white noise doesn't detract from what do I really need to get out of this at the end, because you or your client, if you're representing someone, what matters is what did they define as success and what they define as a win. And in this case, on the macro level, and again, going back to my farmer's market, you can define what that win is and come back for another day.
Yeah, I love that. And like you have said, negotiations are negotiations regardless of the size of the entities involved, regardless of the amount of money involved, even regardless of the number of employees involved. These principles really transcend all of the perimeters.
Absolutely agree. And again, whether it's, every day you're involved in negotiation, whether you're conscious of it or not. And of course, we've added another whole dimension with people negotiating when what days are going to come back to work or come to the office or whether they're going to come at all. So, make your case. And your case is being made in the same way. And you may say, you may be taking the position with your employer. Hey, I don't want to do 5 days, knowing that, hey, I'll do 3 days. That in and of itself, it's the same kind of negotiations. You better know. You better prepare. You better know where your employer is coming from on this scale of reconciliation if you want to put yourself in a position. Because then your appearance of folding, okay, I ain't coming in 5 days, but I'll come in 3 days. Well, and that's what your objective was in the first place. And it's a win because the employer is thinking or concluding they got a win. They've got you to commit. You're now coming back for 3 days. So as you said, doesn't matter what the framework is, the principles are the same.
Yeah. And it's really important. This is something you've mentioned before and resonates with me, that in the end, it's really important for both sides to feel like they got something out of the negotiation. When you nuke, kind of apropos for our conversation, when you nuke the other party in your win, and it's devastating, and they have to acquiesce at this point, they are doing nothing but thinking about how do they get back at you when they can. And that could be just as simple as in labor negotiations, really not showing up to work like they used to. There's so many ways that they can do it. So it's imperative to have, because they're not only your opponent, they're also your partners often. And you've got to keep both of those in mind. It's very important not to get stuck in a binary trap of almost caricature, that they're the bad guys, we're the good guys. That's how you get yourself in serious trouble.
Those are the hallmarks, in my view, of a successful negotiation. And just as you said, history teaches us, and again, whether it's the global stage or as you said, I get a 3-year union agreement, I'm going to see these guys again in 3 years. And so you want to be in a position where you know that even if I'm holding the cards today, I may be dealt a whole different set of cards the next time. And this time the employer may be in a position that, hey, I can't move this facility. I've been required by my vendors, my suppliers, I have to be in this location. There are things that the employer may need when he had the employees at their mercy because the time before they needed to focus on their jobs and they didn't want to lose their job and they were interested in taking pay cuts or whatever. If you squish that person, it's exactly what you said. You sure as heck ain't going to be getting maximum production and quality coming out of that facility if you have crushed the people and you won the battle, but you're going to end up losing the war.
Absolutely. Michael Marino, thank you so much as always. I am Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. Stay tuned for more after this. Welcome back. So the nationally syndicated Price of Business, Hassan Pezzavan, he's joining me. He's an attorney. He specializes in employment law, a longtime regular on the Price of Business Show. But sometimes in the weird times we live in, Hassan, that we can't stay just in the employment law. there's so much going on. And we've got a really hot topic, a really bizarre topic, in my opinion, that's unfolding before our eyes in the area of gerrymandering. And we're going to go into that into a legal conversation, which I think is really refreshing because, frankly, almost everything out there is from a political perspective. And, yes, the politics are huge and obvious, but there's more than that involved. And so take a minute before we jump into it to tell us about your firm and the best website for people to get more information. And welcome, as always.
Thanks. My website is parzfirm.com, P as in Patrick, ARZFIRM.com. And, you know, my major area of practice is labor and employment law, but I think most lawyers, hopefully to some extent, love constitutional law, because it's kind of like what everything else is based on. And in a nutshell, this conversation will focus on that second passion that also a lot of times does tie into employment law, because, you know, you've got a lot of equal protection and discrimination issues, especially with regard to like government employees that go into the employment law arena.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So let's jump into this. And there's a lot of talk about the fact that Trump is trying to target, you know, you and I both live in Texas. So we're talking about Texas a lot, and they're way ahead on the curve of pursuing this, at least unethical, some would argue illegal agenda, which is to try to give the president 5 more votes in Congress by gerrymandering on steroids. Literally, not in some kind of covert sort of way that, frankly, both parties have been guilty of forever, but in a very overt way, cut up the map in order to favor the Republicans, which, you know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the theologian, German theologian who was eventually killed by Hitler, you know, he said that the biggest problem facing a nation isn't evil, it's stupidity. And what is stupidity, he asked? Stupidity is the inability or unwillingness to ask what happens next. And so when I look at this policy that's happening of trying to arm with states that have a trifecta of Republican House, Republican Senate, and Republican governors, you know, to do this, what happens when they are taken over by Democrats? What happens to states that already have it taken over by Democrats? Well, we know what happens there. They're already beginning to move things in California. And so, this is lawlessness on steroids, and they're not even shy about it. It's an incredible set of developments that most people seem to be more concerned about their portfolio than this type of activity that really speaks to the point of liberty itself.
Yeah. So no doubt. And I think, you know, we're likely to see a sort of gerrymandering arms race, you know, triggered by the state of Texas if this continues. Worth noting for your viewers and listeners who may not know in terms of how things work. Every 10 years, when we have a census, the districts are redrawn, you know, as a result of that census. But what Texas is doing is highly uncommon, because they are redrawing at the middle of the decade, as opposed to at the beginning of the decade. And to be honest, their districts were pretty gerrymandered already whenever they started, whenever they redrew for the 2022 elections. They made sure to insulate some Republican representatives and make sure that the map was Democratic districts were basically packed with Democrats, so that they could get maybe not the maximum number, but ensure that there were a really, really good number of Republicans who were very, very safe in their districts.
Yeah, actually, to me, when I look at it, they were pushing the envelope, almost borderline purple, you know, strong leaning red, but not, you know, they wanted to get the maximum number, which makes me think this can come back to haunt them, because a lot of their districts, to me, are very fragile. Where you saw, you know, overwhelming majorities, were in the hand-select Democrat districts that they tried to dump all of those voters. That would be an expression the GOP would use, dump all of their supporters in a Sheila Jackson Lee district. And, you know, which is no longer there. In fact, they've had, you know, it is a vacant seat because the governor won't allow them to have a special election. That's unheard of because they know exactly how it's going to turn out. In my opinion, they created a very fragile environment for Republicans beyond a certain number of seats because of, you know, huge optimism of what, you know, of Republican support for Trump. Boy, off your elections, good luck with that. I think even if they pull this off, the part that's so problematic about this, though, is the overt nature of that. And that's something I see a lot in the Trump administration. He does things that has historically never been allowed, things that when going through the court will essentially be overturned if the court does what its constitutional responsibility requires, stuff in the ethical space. The conversations that he overtly had about the free plane he got for the U.S. government, the new Air Force One. And it's almost like if I talk about my criminal behavior, potentially criminal behavior, I don't want to use words that's going to get me in trouble. If I talk about it, it mitigates it from being a problem. Wait a minute. I'm not doing anything criminal. How would I talk about it if it were criminal? It doesn't work that way.
Yes, it's the perfect phone call, right, from the Georgia election context as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so we end up in this, you know, scenario where the one loser in this is going to be, if this gerrymandering arms race persists, the key loser will be moderates, you know, ultimately, because there will be no moderate districts. That, to me, if you were really honestly trying to draw districts, I think, like, if I could just, you know, draw up legislation as to how districts should be drawn, I would almost make it so that there were as many swing districts as possible, as opposed to Democratic and Republican districts, or at least make a requirement that swing districts would have to be drawn. And because ultimately you really need those moderates to have a functioning government. You need a middle in this country. And right now we really don't have it. I mean, there might be like,
yeah.
In the Republican Party, I think they're basically zero. Anybody who was moderate has been weeded out. And in the Democratic Party, there might be, I don't know, 15 maybe.
Yeah. 15-ish. Yeah. No question about it. There's a couple in the Senate in the GOP that, you know, Susan Collins, for example, who every once in a while goes all right wing because it's red meat and she suffers existentially if she doesn't comply. But you know, those her and Alaska senator, those two
Murkowski.
Women are really, yeah, they're the really closest thing to a moderate in the GOP these days. It's incredible when I see that, and I couldn't agree with you more. You know, this is why people have such a cynical view. And by the way, I blame the media a lot for this. They have sat there and they've looked at the situation and they go, oh, we get way stronger ratings if politics is controversial and extreme than we do when it's normal. And Sleepy Joe was a killer. And Sleepy Joe had his own problems. This is not an endorsement for Joe Biden. But he made politics boring and media suffered huge because of that. And I think now there's a business bias for these media to keep politics interesting, aka extreme.
No doubt. I think the media, obviously the ratings play up on trying to show extreme voices, and I think social media too is so soundbited that it's like, oh, you know, you have this. this one very, very extreme liberal or extreme conservative person that is being interviewed. And then, you know, social media attempts to typecast that as the entire Republican or Democratic Party when, you know, that's some very, very, you know, out there view, right? And so that's, you know, it's red meat for both bases to some extent or another.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be running out of time pretty quickly. I want you to give us some takeaways, if you will, about the situation for the listener.
Well, you know, historically, and that's why I was kind of talking about constitutional law, there was an opportunity to basically declare gerrymandering unconstitutional. And Justice Kennedy at the time was the swing vote. And he said, basically, if you can mathematically define gerrymandering, then, you know, I'll be willing to vote, you know, against it if we can make it definable in a nutshell. But unfortunately, you know, the court was like 5-4 historically, with Kennedy kind of saying, hey, if we can get a mathematical definition, I'd be willing to declare it unconstitutional. And I'm paraphrasing. And I wish with all of my heart that we would have gotten that decision. The Democrats, to their credit, they did vote for the, I believe it was like the For the People Act or whatever, in the House at that time. And they had no Republican support, but one of the tenets of that act was to get rid of all gerrymandering, you know, to basically kind of define and eliminate it. For the moment, I just don't see a lot of hope in this political climate. And I wish I had faith in the Supreme Court that they would. It's kind of seeing this arms race evolving that they would, you know, wake up and say, okay, like this is really, really bad for the country. We've got to delimit, define and illegalize this to some extent. But I don't think that that's extremely likely.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, and I that's not conspiratorial. That's not. This is a right wing court. That is just the nature of this particular court in terms of hesitating. They think this is a Congress origin issue, and it is historically. But for courts getting you know, making some bold and you know extra constitutional decisions, if you will, over the year. Years, we'd still be in slavery. At the very least, you know, huge numbers of Americans would not be allowed to vote. I think that it would have been appropriate. It's been appropriate because we are meandering towards authoritarianism if we're not already there with the extremism on both sides. It's horrific. And I'm sorry, I know you can comment on that. And I'm in clock trouble. But always love having you on the program. You want to say one final thought, 30 seconds or less, go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult issue. But I think the principle of democracy really should win over originalist philosophy. And when you gerrymander, you're basically denying democracy its true right.
Yeah, and I concur with that. And I'm not even saying that they're right for having an originalist attitude. I'm just observing they have an originalist attitude. That's all I'm doing.
Yeah. Right.
But very good, lively conversation. It's not close to them. Thank you so much. I'm Kevin Price. This is The Price of Business.
That wraps up another Price of Business. I am. Glad to be with you. Really enjoyed it and enjoying our new home here on these stations around the country. I do want to remind you that the show continues 24/7. Not only do we have this weekly show that you can hear on this station, but we're on other stations around the country with a daily program as well. You can easily learn about them by visiting us at priceofbusiness.com. We affectionately say It is a show that never ends. And what we mean by that is that it continues 24/7 with the addition of new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com. While there, we'd like you to engage with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Kevin Price Live and all of our sister sites as well. All right, I'm going to take a break until next time. Next week, we'll be back with you with much more information for you, and look forward to that conversation. And I want to say, again, thank you to USA Business Radio to make it possible for this to have been commercial-free, an entire hour of commercial-free. And guess what? Even more commercial-free than public radio. So we're excited about that. Enjoy the rest of your day right here on this station.